Hello and welcome to episode 3 of the new RTE Rugby podcast, available on RTE.ie, iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts. You can contact us on Twitter at RTE Rugby or Facebook /RTE Sport. Yeah, thanks for joining in today. Our new-ish RTE Rugby podcast, the only place where that carefully contrived, spontaneous, loose, chaotic style is actually real and spontaneous, if it happens at all. Hopefully it will, because today's guests are Emmett Byrne, former Irish Rugby International, Wes Liddy, the RTE Rugby producer, Michael Glennon of RTE Online Sport, and a little later we'll be joined by Fiona Coughlan, Ireland's 2013 Grand Slam winning captain, to chat about what a season it's been so far and what's in store for the women's team. But I'm going to start with Emmett, because Emmett and myself used to do a bit of punditry down the years, or you used to do the punditry and I used to try and do the presenting, and time flies. Congratulations, you've had your first child.
Yeah, I have, Dara, yeah. And you know that old kind of boring line when people say to you it's the best thing that ever happened to you and you just brush them off? Probably actually is, to be quite honest, you know, but you have to have it for you to kind of get what they mean. But yeah, no, it's been great. It really has.
And did it ever strike you what an awful selfish human being you were until you had a child?
Yeah, it's a good point, actually. Yeah, it's a good point. I think I probably had it in the back of my head all the time, but didn't realise the clock was ticking, you know. When you have the head down, you're not watching the clock, and then suddenly you come up for air and then something like this happens, then you realise, God, I really did leave this late. But no, it's better late than never, as they say, sure. And it's great. It's great.
And you're in your mid-40s.
I am. Do you want, 45, yeah. Bang in the middle, yeah.
So, I mean, you quit when? Was it 2006?
Six, yeah.
Right, so you're gone. I mean, a remarkable 33. 13 years, so yeah. Much has happened. But you were there for the birth of the kind of major professionalisation and success.
Yeah, I was there in 95 to 06, which is the kind of start of the professional game. And it was a very interesting period in Irish rugby, really, because, and rugby in general, because the professional era started almost overnight when there was a lot of humming and hawing about it. And then one day we literally went in and we were getting checks for something that we did for free, and it was quite amazing. But when you're 21, 22 and you're signing a dotted line eventually for a contract, you're not thinking about the end game. And this is the thing about the complications and the other bits and pieces that go with it and where the game itself is going to go. Because really it was the professional game you see today, and the attitudes and the understanding and the science behind it and all the rest, was something that evolved over this period of time, you know, these years that have, I suppose, really it's 20 plus years that it's got to this point. And it's been taken, you know, probably when I started, I mean, to put a number on it would be just probably a bit unfair, but I'm going to do it anyway. And I'd say it probably took 5 to 6 years from the 95 to kind of early 2000s, really, before the game started really hitting its straps from a professional point of view. And then in 03, it made another jump. After the World Cup, based on how teams defend and how they deal with space and stuff, from the specifics of it, and the advances of analysis has changed the game dramatically. So now the game, when I was playing, was very much, you know, at the very highest level, the individual was a very key component to success in the game. Now the sum of the parts becomes much more relevant because the analysis is so good.
QED Joe Schmidt.
Yeah, Joe's detail. And what Joe does, I mean, just from my observations, and I just want to say this, I haven't watched or broke down as much rugby as I have in the past. I mean, in the old days, I mean, due to time, I mean, getting into studio and doing analysis wasn't the problem.
You've become a GP, which we'll talk about in a minute, rugby.
Yeah, so time constraints due to, I suppose, just life in general, and just getting and then upskilling to get back into the workforce, I suppose, has taken up a lot of the ability for me to sit down and analyse rugby. And then as a result of that, I didn't feel going into the studio and talking about it when it wasn't as close to it was relevant, you know.
But sometimes that's fresher for us, because everybody is absolutely up against it so closely now, and everything is overanalyzed. And even in the last 5 or 6 years, there's a million different channels now to get your rugby analysis. By channels, I mean online and traditional.
Yeah. And I think when you're watching a game a lot, you don't see the subtleties, the changes, and it can be quite subtle. And then you, like, if you took the game, you know, 10 years ago and put it in a split screen beside it now, you'd see significant differences, as you would have 10 years before that. Like, and I like to use...
Like what, Emmett?
Well, I like to use an defense is the best way to use that as an analogy. So when I started playing, we would analyze, and we did a bit of analysis. Like, we didn't understand the value of it at the time, to be honest, but we might have looked at defense and a missed tackle and a tackle. And so you miss a tackle or you make it. But then over time, we realized, as was demonstrated only 2 weeks ago, that there's a direct correlation between impact tackles and outcomes in games. So you look at England
this
making
the 40. Dominant tackle phrase,
yeah.
We were hearing.
So then we realised that. And then there was a value in doing an analysis in terms of a breakdown of a tackle where you had a missed tackle, a soak tackle, which is a tackle where you lose the collision but make it, a neutral tackle where it is an even break on the collision, and then an impact tackle where you actually make the tackle and drive them back. So we broke it down into four different things. And if we were able to, say, for example, get more of the impact tackles, say, or affect more impact tackles throughout a game, then that would have a direct outcome on the score of the game. And that's basically controlling the gain line, which is what England did against Ireland. And I suppose, in a sense, Scotland didn't, and Ireland did a bit more of it last time. And that has a huge relevance. Now, and I was just sitting down watching it with a couple of guys, say about 6 months ago, with a couple of guys who've retired after I did, but were under Joe for a while. And they were saying that Joe looks at five things after the tackle. And this is how the game has evolved. And I haven't, you know, to keep up the speed of this.
Can you even remember what they are?
Well, getting over the ball, driving over the ball, identifying where the ball is. That's the sort of thing you're talking about. But they're the things, like, Joe works off guidelines. And he doesn't probably use those terms. But from what I can see, he gives the players guidelines of what to do on the pitch. So when the ball goes into play, and this is the same for any team sport, you apply the mathematical model of chaos theory, which means that anything can happen at any given time and in a random environment. But there are rules and regulations and certain skills that are applied within that random environment. And that's what...
And this is the tenor of the discussion that Joe or his equivalent would have with the modern pro.
He would not. He probably wouldn't, say, for example, go into the
chaos theory.
I think you can overcoach and confuse people. You need to be able to give guys the tools, skills as to what they need to be able to execute at any given time, when is the best, most likely time to use those skills. And that is what he does with each of the players. So they have a template to work off, like guidelines. And then, what am I thinking? What should I be thinking on the pitch at any given time? Where should I be? And this is what really... what gives the guys the confidence, because they know that this system works very well, so you can slot guys in and out very, very quickly.
Sure, interchangeability almost.
Exactly.
Wes, what are you thinking? Because I know you love the detail. I mean, you're listening to Emmett there.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And we're talking about detail, but actually, in a funny way, we're kind of come completely back on ourselves, because, you know, Emmett says, who would have known, you know, we learned a couple of weeks ago that the dominant tackles make a difference to the outcome, and you're kind of going, we probably didn't need a scientist to tell us that. That was probably always apparent. Like, I see a stat here, I saw the weekend, that Nick Winkelmann, the head of kind of S&C guru for all of Irish rugby, put up. There was a study done last year, and in 96 games between Tier 1 nations, the average carry predicted the outcome on 71% of occasions. So, now that sounds really impressive, but you're kind of going, yeah, well, it makes sense. Like, the team that gained more metres in a carry won the game. So it's almost like the more detail is sometimes actually producing the realisation that the simple things are still
unbelievably important. In a way. But, like, so what is the purpose, Emmett, in your opinion, of the increased scientification of the game?
Yeah, well, it's a good way of putting it, the way Wes is talking there. And I suppose I'll put it in the language that I can see it, is that it clarifies what works and clarifies what doesn't work. And then you're able to instill into the player the absolute belief of carrying out these skills at any given time is what's going to work within the game.
Is there a certain type of character who can do that better, regardless of their physical attributes?
It's all about attitude, in my opinion, okay? Because physical attributes are the learned skills in terms of getting bigger, stronger, fitter. There's a thing called natural selection now, where people are naturally grabbed, bigger men go in for bigger positions. Since 95, when Loma was picked on the wing and drift defences couldn't deal with him, they started using hard-up defences. Now, it took a while for people to figure out that. Hard-up defences cut down time and space, which increase collisions, which mean bigger men win collisions, hence natural selection towards bigger men. So that's going to happen. And these bigger men respond well in things like gyms and nutritional programs, etc., etc. So that's kind of, we can fix that. But the things like skill is what's separating the teams now. When you look at the likes of and the organization and the patterns, and like the All Blacks are a good best example, because they're the best team over the course of any given period of time. And when you look at, for example, I suppose the way I would describe it is they focus a lot more on skills than they would on their baseline absolute strength or, you know, absolute fitness, because they are fit and strong. But they understand that you have to work within 20% of relative fitness and strength of any given opponent, and then their skills become relevant. What but I mean,
do you think their baseline, though, with such a large preponderance of Polynesian and Maori players and the different genetic makeup there, that they don't have to worry, like where Irish people struggle is generally explosive power, as opposed to size. So they, it isn't such an issue for them.
It is an advantage. I mean, if you put evolution on hold for 200,000 years, we might catch up with them here. But I mean, the reality is that they have a genetic pool, a gene pool, because they do, for to some degree, have a pick of the Polynesian Islands, and they've a, they've a, they've a, you know, obviously a lot of South Sea Islanders within New Zealand itself that have a, you know, genetics that just make them that little bigger, more powerful, and adaptable to rugby. But having said that, there's other skills that there are other parts of the of their makeup that make them less suitable to the way they play rugby as well. It doesn't help with conditioning, with skills, with strategy, all those other bits and pieces. It helps in one aspect or two aspects of the game, speed and power and so on. But Ireland have to work a little bit harder for that. But you, but it's not a complete and utter, you know, blind advantage if you broke it down. So with what they do is, but it, it is true what you say, they don't have to put as much emphasis in the early years particularly onto the likes of the gym work, so they can focus on the skills. But these guys are handling the ball from 4 years of age and running around the field and doing all that and playing tag rugby.
Well, that's cultural.
It is. That's a cult. Now, I'm going to talk about that in a sec, but I'll just, I suppose I'll finish this point first because otherwise it'll make no sense. But the whole idea of relative strength within playing against, like, it's the reason the strongest man in the world or the fittest man in the world isn't the best at every sport is because skills are very relevant. And what I mean by 20% relative strength come within that. If you have an adult, like a grown, big, strong, aggressive man, and you put him in a boxing ring with a 10-year-old child with lovely boxing skills, the child will be overwhelmed because the power of the man is so far ahead of him. Mm-hmm. And likewise, in any physical sport, if you're not within 20% of the relative strength of your opponent, your skills become irrelevant. But once you get to that point, and that's all New Zealand are worried about, they go, we need to get to within a certain level of strength of these guys, and then we can apply our skills. And their skills are so manifested from a young age that they don't have to think about execution of a skill under pressure like the way some other teams do. And that means that in that random environment that I explained earlier on, where anything can happen at any given time, you can devote more of your brain power to that and an analysis of that random environment, and then less on the absolute execution of the skill, where some people have to think about executing the skill and it takes away from that analysis.
More oxygen of what's going in the brain for
specifics, yeah, of for decision making. When exactly, yeah. And what I'd say there is the way to put it is like a 32-bit machine playing a 16-bit machine in terms of execution on the field, and that's the way I describe it. So
means nothing to me.
But the culture drives it. Okay, so playing rugby in Ireland is an 8-hour day job. Let's say, for argument's sake, it's not an 8-hour training day. It's like you might go in it, do prehabilitation, a bit of ice baths. You'll eat a bit of food. You'll probably do analysis, team meeting. You might do an on-pitch session. You might do a cool-off, and then you go home. Okay, so it could take 6-8 hours.
Is rugby getting any better to watch?
Well, that's a different question.
I know, that's why I asked it. You said to me off-camera or off mic that you're sick of watching bad rugby.
Well,
there's a lot of it out there.
I'll explain that. That's a longer answer. What I'm going to say about culture is, though, in New Zealand, the culture is 24-7. Over here, it's a job. It's 8 hours a day. And the 24-7-hour culture drives that agenda that they win. Now, just to go back, the question of bad rugby is that the disparity between good and bad rugby has grown. But the highest level of rugby is still absolutely outstanding. It's probably the best rugby we'll see.
Despite defences dominating and, I mean, is it great from a purist point of view or from a punter on the street?
Funny you mention that. I had a conversation with somebody who would have watched rugby over the last 30, 40 years, man in his, say, 50s, and he said, I don't like watching it as much now. But, I mean, it's because it's become, he said, in his words, like rugby league, where it's a collision sport versus a contact sport with any sort of level of space. But if you understand how difficult it is to create the space and how difficult it is to carry a ball under pressure when somebody's passing it. If you understand the minutiae of the skills, you can appreciate it. Mm-hmm. If you're a casual observer, I'd say the older game was possibly, you know, attractive because guys were able to find space easier and so on.
Yeah, like, really interesting stuff. Loads of points. But, I mean, just on the New Zealand thing, one was, I don't know, Tom McCartney, the Connacht hooker, came up here from Auckland. like his nickname in Auckland was the Freak. He was the strongest person in the gym down there with the Auckland Blues, which had, you know, Ma Nanu guys like that playing at the time. He wasn't even really mapped in the Connacht system in terms of his numbers in the gym. So, I mean, if you watch, I've seen a couple of All Blacks gym sessions and it's all, you know, counter-resistance movement rather than weights, a lot of it, because they're focusing on explosiveness, kind of maybe possibly more game relevant stuff.
Counter resistance, what, like scrum machine?
Using your own body weight against you
rather than
lifting inanimate objects. Mm-hmm. And I suppose where that ties in with what Emmett was saying with the culture is, I remember Paul O'Connell saying, what was the difference between a kid coming of age in New Zealand at 18 or 19 about to make it into the professional pathway, to use the phrase, is because it's the number one sport, because that's what they play in the yard at lunch, because that's what they play when they go home. Your 18, 19-year-old lock about to make it in North Harbour versus your 18, 19-year-old lock about to make it from Tralee, he's about 1,000 hours more with a ball in his hand.
Does Malcolm Gladwell theory here nearly?
Well, he just has. So, and with that comes decision-making. And Emmett was saying about if you get within 20%, it's about skill. But I think you can actually drill that down further and maybe they're one and the same, but there's two components, I would say. I'd say it's skill and it's also intelligence, game-specific intelligence, especially when you're talking about understanding and being able to implement.
Have we a
minutia?
Way of finding that metric? Can you measure? And it's not IQ as in Nobel Prize stuff.
Mentioned evolution. And like,
but my question is, are we coming to a case, are coming to a stage where a player will be almost auditioned on the basis of their brain power as well?
There's things in use in Premiership Soccer Academies now, and I know this because I studied with a guy who's devised one of these models, but there's a model called Holistic Talent Assessment, which is, you know, environmental factors, psychometric measures, ability on the field. And like, for example, Man City have an academy in the Ivory Coast, and they will weed out 800 of the first 1,000 based purely on this holistic assessment, because the indicators are so strong. As to what kind of guy will make it, whether that's emotional intelligence that people love to throw around now, which is really just like, can you regulate your emotional response to an external stimulus? So, i.e., if you come over from the Ivory Coast, what's the biggest problem facing you? You're going to get homesick. It's a cultural adjustment. Are you emotionally aware enough to realise, I am homesick, this will pass, the prize at the end of the tunnel is huge, therefore I'm not going to panic and jump on a plane home, I'm going to put my head down and work twice as hard. Like, so what seems kind of scientific mumbo-jumbo is actually common sense wrapped in science sometimes.
So the chap coming out of Clongowes would have to go through the same dislocation feeling, would he?
You can assess him, well, no, he probably wouldn't, but I think you can probably assess without looking at a guy on a field. Now, the outstanding talent you're going to work with and improvise around his mental frailties or otherwise all the time.
The individuals.
We in Ireland don't have the luxury to deviate from that. But yeah, I think you could assess 17, 18-year-olds without seeing them play and go, he won't make it, he'll make it, he won't make it. Because if you don't have work ethic, ambition, resilience, there's not a chance you're making it as a professional.
Forget about the muscles, yeah.
It's just not happening. So you could weed out a lot of people. Like, if you say evolution and rugby's a pro sport since 1995, which is really modern, like if you go back to the 70s in England, the Premiership, which is now the biggest sporting league in the world, give or take, there was no black players playing in it at one point.
Viv Anderson, we remember. Yeah. Jimmy Hill was Laurie Cunningham,
to allow them be paid minimum wage. Not too far before that, as the head of the PFA or whatever it was called in that incarnation. So if you look at the quantum leaps that sport has made, like, where does rugby go in the next 20 years? Emma talked about the difference in analysis from 1995 to now. Sure, in 20 years, we've no idea where this has gone.
We'll have a stab. I mean, that's why we have a podcast.
Well, driver of anything tends to be, big driver is always money. Okay, that's going to be the driver. It depends on how big the game gets and how will definitely be the goldfish bowl of determinants.
But if money was unlimited for the best talent, I mean, what would the game look like?
America.
It'd look like the NFL.
Well,
it would tap into that market for sure, yeah, in terms of athletes.
You exhaust every corner of the game, from the advertising, marketing, the as you say, the athletic profiling, all those bits and pieces. That's a kind of relatively new science, that what you're talking, and science becomes science in the terms of, you know, believable evidence-based kind of information when you've studied it and repeated it enough, and it's repeatable. That's what it is. Mm. So when you take, for example, certain types of personalities that are successful in a given environment...
So you need to build up the knowledge
of what leads to those personalities. And the ones that have done it the most are the military. Okay, so the military in the United States are the guys who do the most personality profiling.
It's eugenics by another name, in a way, isn't it? Or, well, not eugenics, because that's kind of in terms of weeding out genes alone. But it's a very Darwinian approach to what'll work and what won't. And
but
if it won't work,
everything goes back to that, Dara. And that's the way, because that's our DNA is what, that's what'll come out at the end of the day, whether it's driven by a different factors or what factors drive it.
That's everyday life.
Yeah, well, absolutely. But it is. And success, you find that success with some people in any walk of life can apply the same principles, relevant principles. The differentials are circumstance and maybe physiology and anthropometry, which is the size of you as a person and your ability to use that.
Okay, so come on back down to earth, because, this is... To me, it is fascinating, and I hope anyone who doesn't find it fascinating will have turned off by now. But I know that the way people consume sport is changing, as well as the way people play sport, and people are fascinated with this stuff. Mm. Back to you. So the GP thing. Mm. When did you actually get your parchment or whatever it's called that you're a GP?
Finished in 2006. With the rugby and started medicine in 2007, and that was 5 years. Graduated in 2012 from medical school, internship 2012-2013.
You had a great student flat, I remember that.
Oh yeah.
Go on.
I was living in the Berkeley Court at the time, in the penthouse of the Berkeley
Court.
Just
when the economy collapsed, Everett was meant to be there for 6 months and ended up there for about 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, I was laughing. I was walking
around. No one owned it. Couldn't find an owner.
I was walking around when the manager was kind of showing me around, because it had been reopened as a budget hotel, but you don't open a 3,000 square foot penthouse in a budget hotel. He was showing us around, and I said,
what was your rent there? Grand a month or something?
I was a bit more than that, but I was pretending, there was two bedrooms there, but with another guy, Daniel Ryan, a friend of mine, your mum was showing us around, and I was pretending not to be impressed, and I would have bitten the hand off him at the time. Yeah. I said, if I got a few months out of this, I'll be winning. But we ended up there 5 years, so probably all the med school.
It was a good collapse for you, wasn't it? It was a good recession.
Well, I think it was a good time, probably not to be. I hadn't got time to worry about recessions and things of that, So, which was a godsend in many ways. Apart from I was very grateful to be able to go back and take on medicine at that time. And
you had a few bob in the bank from your rugby career.
Kept me going. I mean, it was great. And at the time, I was doing a fair bit of the analysis. And I mean, because I was very fresh out of the game as well, it was something that. The changes that were going on within the game were kind of coming to me relatively quickly when you're studying a fair bit of it. The big thing that stopped me was the time to sit down and watch the games. You need to be looking at a good few hours of rugby a week to stay up to date. As I already mentioned, the game moves on very, very quickly, even though it's subtle to a lot to people who are watching a lot of it. So...
But anyway, take us up to speed, because you're specialising now, even though you're a GP.
I did a general practice then 4 years in the Trinity scheme from 2013 to 2017, then graduated. So that means you're specialised when you've done that. So that's a 10-year run to get all that. And then I have a specific interest in exercise medicine, and that's a hangover from the rugby days, because I was always very interested in strength and conditioning, nutrition, etc. And I felt that was a very good approach to take with patients that maybe weren't employing those. Like, the four pillars of anyone's health on a day-to-day basis that mean more than any sort of, I think, that are more important than any, I don't mean... more important than taking medication, but it does more for your health in a general sense than taking medication, having surgeries, or being engaged in the healthcare system. Would be your make sure you move, mechanical work with muscle. Okay, so that's exercise of forms, which we can
don't
discuss.
Sit in your ass
exactly. And I can discuss the variables within that if you want, but it's that's a lot. Nutrition, okay. Mm-hmm. So again, that's a big thing. So I can discuss that if you want at some time, but. stress management. Okay, so mm-hmm. we release a lot of chemicals into the body when we're chronically stressed, which do a lot of damage to us. Okay, which again, it's a big subject. So I'll talk if you ever want to talk again. And then the third would be sleep. So if you get those four things right in your life on a day-to-day basis, say, let's just say, to keep it relatively simple, the 80-20 rule within those, with each of those things, I think you're doing the best thing for your health with regard to that. So I took that approach to some degree to medicine. And I work within a program for a medical exercise intervention program for chronic disease.
Where do people come and see you? I know this isn't an advertising, but
so that's a referral to it's a MedX program, which is in Tala Hospital. So that's so you just make a referral to Tala Hospital under MedX.
And the sleep thing makes so much sense. Yeah. I was talking to my partner last night, who's a nutritionist actually, and she was saying that I was unaware of this. She said 11 till 7 is the golden thing for sleep, and 11 till 1 you bust your cancer. Baddies, that's what your body does between 11 and 1. Between 1 and 3, you regenerate your liver, etc., etc. It's handy for a lot of people. I can't remember the 3 till 5 bit. And the 5 to 7 is when your mental health is improved, because that's when you have your dreams and
your REM sleep.
Sleep.
It's interesting, I mean, I haven't heard it put like that, but the way I'd put it is 10:30, 11 at night, from studies have shown that that is the best time to go to sleep. Because we're linked inextricably with a circadian rhythm. So people who go to bed at 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning and stuff, and sleep for 8 hours, don't get the same quality sleep as somebody who goes to bed at, and that's just because that's the way we're wired over 200,000 years.
What about babies then, Wes? As young babies as well. So do you get sleep?
No. You for years now.
You hate your life quite a lot when I see you these days, because you're completely exhausted.
Yeah. I mean... I didn't want to sour the whole experience from talking about it being the best day of his life, but he'll soon learn
that one.
I was we were overnight in Murrayfield or in Edinburgh, and so my one night without two babies was I just be home at 9:30 and just got my sleep. So the sleep was my
That's my the treat. A hotel bedroom with like just yourself and a telly.
I've been hearing that. And to be fair, my my partner Eileen, she's been doing most of the heavy lifting with the breastfeeding and stuff. So I've been lucky so far. But I think it's you know, I suppose you're still in that kind of phase where it's so new and exciting as well. I'm not thinking, but I do realize it's probably a hit coming down the road. All right,
no, I'm past it, and I think it was wonderful. This is the way nature works as well.
It's great. In the rear view.
Well, this is definitely there's some sort of memory tricks going on, because I absolutely I romanticize it now. And I can assure you can ask my ex-wife, I'd say, wasn't that romantic, shouting and roaring in the middle of the night, get that child away. But yeah, what else would we be doing? Nobody else has found a superior purpose to life, really, have they?
No, I don't think so. I mean, as I said, I
maybe the monks out in the Skellig or something, but
it depends, I suppose. It's an individual thing as well, isn't it? Like, you know, it's not, I mean, everybody, there are very people who are happy without going down that road as well. But I have to say that from my own point of view, it's what, I always find that when you make big decisions in your life, they tend to be planted quite early, or like it's not something you make a decision on, and you know, it happens that way, but it's not something when you've planned it that you've decided on a Friday and you execute on a Monday type of thing. Like, these are any of the big decisions I've made, whether it's going back to study, whether it's, you know, maybe going after rugby, whether it's having a family, whatever it is, it's something that
you're a sickener, basically, because I know you decided to take up jiu-jitsu as a kind of a half a hobby as well. And next thing you were on the Irish team, and that's when you were about 40.
I competed in the UK Open in jiu-jitsu. Yeah, that was a while ago now. But the thing I liked about jiu-jitsu was it was a form of physicality that I missed. So when you play rugby, obviously, I think one of the things that, I don't know if guys mentioned this, but I think men are meant to be doing quite physical things, and when you play rugby, it's at an extreme version of that, and you kind of have a mini face your fear kind of moment each time you play a game, particularly when I was propping, because you're up against kind of guys that are
interesting ways. Yeah. People don't talk about it that basically, like, because we assume these guys are absolute just murder for physical contact, but it's still a fear. There's still like the elemental fear of getting the head knocked off you.
Well, there's a willingness to. You have to have a willingness to, I suppose, put that fear to bed anyway. I mean, you look at the way Ireland have played last few years with it being so attritional, and like the likes of that England game, you know your opposite number in most cases is a good bit bigger, more powerful than you.
Yeah.
So you know you're going to get knocked around the place, but That's the job.
Well, that's true. And it's not a fear of the opposition, my point. It's a fear of failure, because you know the opposition are going to test you to the limits of your abilities.
So you're putting yourself out there, really. Like.
Well, you are. It's an exposure. And you have to take your mind. I had this. I never went to a sports psychologist in my life, but I did... A form of psychology and how I approach games evolved over the years when I was doing it, that took my head into a space where I was able to face that and take it on, you know, that kind of way. And I think everyone who plays rugby has their own version of that too, you know, who goes out and does that. The jiu-jitsu thing came because, just to go back on that point there, because you brought it up, was that it offered you physicality without the high velocity collisions of rugby. So your joints are what is going to limit, is your rate limiting step and going forward in high impact things, you know, games like that. You know, head injuries are becoming apparent now, but the
you
thing that stops a lot of people
fit to perform a jiu-jitsu too, though, isn't it? I mean,
at a high level, it's a very fit. It's very fit. Yeah, guys are. It's a tough sport, like very tough. It doesn't have, as I said, the high velocity collisions, but it's very physical. Yeah, okay. And that's that kind of filled the gap for me.
Great. We're going to come back and just broaden it out a little bit in a second, because
Jesus,
I know
we'll be doing well to broaden it out from eugenics, jiu-jitsu, and parenting. Now, to be
we'll
fair.
Narrow it in so to rugby. But you can pick up Emmett's new book, How to Underachieve and Be Happy in any good bookshop. Thanks, Emmett. We'll be back with Michael Glennon, Wes and Emmett in just a minute. Right, we're back. So let's go and find out what's going on in RTE Online with Michael. Kieran Marmion is getting a few clicks.
Yeah, just one of the top stories on our website. And he obviously played against New Zealand in that win in November, and he was carrying that injury, and the IRFU sent him for surgery shortly afterwards.
Ankle.
And they said 12 weeks, and I'm just looking, it's 12 weeks on the button. He's back training with Connacht and expected to play at the weekend against the Cheetahs. So that's...
Which is apposite given the scrum half alleged crisis at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, that is a funny one. I mean... John Cooney has got 8 minutes over two games, so whether that builds strength and depth, who knows. Marmion has always been the preferred scrum half. He has 24 caps with Conor Murray on the scene as well. Also, with Johnny Holland's coaching column, he is assessing the Scotland performance of where Ireland are at the moment, reckons they're unconvincing. I think that's the consensus, and maybe Rob Kearney actually made, there was a big statement about Rob Kearney and all the talk that had preceded that match, and then it probably ended now after what he did against Scotland.
There was an interesting one in Johnny's column, actually, and I agree with him, and maybe Emmett had shed some light on it, but a lot of people have said it since, but, you know, this notion that we were under huge pressure to perform on Sunday, which we could see and was the
Saturday.
It's very hard to understand how that pressure was so huge on the back of one loss, with 17 good wins in the bank prior to that. It almost seemed like the reaction to it was completely over the top.
That's the world we live in.
It was the manner more than the defeat. If it was just a one-point loss.
I still find it odd that one performance would rock a high-achieving team to that extent.
That's a very valid point. But I think... It's the you know when you watch a game, and I know from talking to people that don't watch or study rugby, and they're able to tell me roughly the nature of a loss, and even if the scoreline doesn't show up, by just watching the game, because they have an instinctive kind of feel for how the game is going. I don't know if that makes sense. And just the general public, I think, would have saw that game as an utter dominance of what England did in Ireland, and we didn't think that was possible at this given time. And I think I was surprised. I mean, I actually thought that English team could have beaten Ireland. I know hindsight and all that and whatever. I thought, if you had to put a gun to my head, honestly, I would have said Ireland by five. But I was talking to people, you know,
and
just
if you
around
saw
the general,
England winning, you would have predicted it to unfold in exactly the way it did.
Probably, but actually, I would have thought if I had saw England winning, it would have been a narrow game, I'll put it in context. I've never seen New Zealand dominated like that at home. Home, I've seen them lose at home by a point or two in the, you know,
that's
the line minutes of the game.
Whereas
Ireland got utterly beaten up and taken out. Now Joe said that the fellas weren't in the right mindset, but I mean, it's England at home. you know. And at the end of the day, I think the pressure prior to the Six Nations is telling on the players' mentality right now. And I think that's what it is. I think the pressure of expectation. We had an amazing 2018. It's nearly impossible to repeat, you know, one after the other, unless you're able to revolutionise the way they're playing the game in a short period of time. And to put that in, what I mean by that is that what you did last year is not going to work this year to win these competitions. They need to come up with something new. So if you, for example...
But intensity is attached to having something new to do on the field, you say? Because the
it can be what motivates you, that's doing that something new well.
Yes.
You know,
that's what I'm getting from what Emmett's saying, yeah, because obviously we're talking about it, your brain.
In the whole week leading up to the Scotland game, right, and this isn't indicative of the players, I didn't hear it from them or I didn't speak to any of them or anything like that, but I didn't hear one person reference the Scotland game in the context of it being World a Cup. Dress rehearsal for our pivotal World Cup game in 8 months' time, which is bizarre. That like that is a clear indication that the public, at least, were very much looking beyond that game and even that game in 8 months.
Look, in all walks of Irish life, there's an element of car crash as well that we can't, it's like, oh my God, we're just after spending a year saying that this is the greatest thing ever and now look at it, it's all going to collapse, isn't it terrible? I thought there was a bit of that to the Scotland game.
Well, I'll ask you a question. Did you think that Ireland were genuine contenders for the World Cup this year before the English game?
I didn't before the All Blacks game. And after that, I was totally on the bandwagon.
Okay.
And so, now I don't know where I am.
So but between the All Blacks and the English game, you felt Ireland could win the World Cup?
Well, back to the kind
win
of...
Win is a big one. The shake-up.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I thought...
But they'll still be in the shake-up.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, anyone could be... The shake-up... Let's be like frank here. There's probably about... How many teams do you think can win the World Cup?
New Zealand, South Africa,
four.
England, and possibly Ireland.
I'd agree with that. Yeah. I'd go with that. Yeah, on the evidence that's presented to us right now.
Well, it has to be New Zealand.
So I wouldn't call four a large number. So that's in the shake-up. Mm. Would you
sure.
say?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But at any given day, you could lose to Scotland.
Also to beat South Africa, England, New Zealand.
That's what's never been
in consecutive weeks. That's, with our style of play and our physical base, seems almost impossible.
Well, that's what I would identify
if
I was Joe Schmidt. That's what I'd be looking at now from a distance. I'd be going, how do I repeat consecutive efforts on a week to week basis to produce performances
that,
like they had against
New Zealand? He accepts that. I mean, he said his vaccination quote, which was, you know, the current injury crisis is forcing him to vaccinate the squad against a repeat of 2015.
Yeah, but
when they lose three or four frontliners,
what Joe puts out is like an iceberg. The tip of what you see is barely anything.
And that's
what's
why
going
I trust
on
him to win the World Cup.
The cogs are working quicker than what you see and what he's thinking and thinking of doing. He's three steps ahead in most cases. I think he's running a little bit out of road at the moment, and that's where the problems are coming.
I'll sound like an absolute idiot for the umpteenth time by saying this,
never.
But I think you look at the way Ireland have been beaten, were beaten by England, and the way they played against Scotland, and one obvious trend is they're getting smashed behind the game line over and over again. They haven't really adjusted in terms of they're still trying to go with one out runners. It's all very congested. There's no way that every Tom, Dick and Harry sitting at home watching the game sees that and Joe Schmidt doesn't. And I do wonder, I know it sounds ridiculous, but is there almost an element of we're going to continue to play flat to the game line, we're going to experiment with a few things, hopefully we're going to get a few results, and this is going to come to fruition, or we're going to learn the best balanced approach to how we counteract these defensive systems in time
There's a double bluff going on somewhere.
Rather than now.
There's an element of bluff.
Because Joe, like, there's no way they were doubling down over and over again. Like, he saw the problems, but they kept doing it. That was what was
So he knows something we don't.
I'd imagine he knows a lot we don't, yeah.
Okay, let's hear from Gary Ringrose. Michael, you were speaking to him, weren't you?
Yeah, I caught up with Gary yesterday. He obviously missed the Scotland match and he's hoping to get back for the Italy game.
Okay.
Gary, welcome to the RTE Rugby podcast. Tell me about your hamstring. How's that coming along?
Yeah, really good, thankfully. Just got a little nick or a little strain in the game against England, so just didn't want it to get any worse. So thankfully it wasn't too bad, and it's responding well to rehab and kind of just taking it as day by day, because I wouldn't have ever had any soft tissue stuff before. It's just kind of being cautious and taking it day by day and seeing how it responds, and certainly after the last 10 days it's responded really well, which is positive.
Do you consider yourself in the running for the Italy game?
I don't know. For me, it's just trying to get back and available for selection really and get back fit between competition and selection, and obviously how well Chris and Bundy did on the weekend, I mean that's kind of out of my control to be honest, so for me to just, it's just to focus on getting back fit and then kind of whatever happens, happens.
What did you make of the Ireland response on Saturday, maybe under a lot of pressure before the England match, under a lot of pressure after the match? How do you think they handled that, and is there a sense of disappointment that there wasn't a bonus point got in terms of what it means in the championship race?
No, I think it was. I think that the lads did incredibly well, and I was proud to see them do as well as they did. Personally, there was there 2 years ago for my first Six Nations game, it was in Murrayfield, so I'd appreciate how tough it is to go and play there, and how tough it is to go and win there. And I think the lads, right across the board, 1-23, really, I mean, put in a massive shift, and yeah, it was amazing to see them get the result against in-form, really tough Scotland team.
You would have bulked up a lot in the last couple of years. It's noticeable in your shape on the pitch. When Joe spoke after the England match about physicality being a reality check, is that something that the whole squad has to take into account? We saw Chris going in at the weekend, a bigger specimen, but is bulking up, when you're thinking of World Cup plans and competing with possibly South Africa and New Zealand, is bulking up on the mind of the Ireland squad?
No, I don't think so. I think what I love about rugby is that no two players are the same. And, you mean, have one position and have 10 different types of players going for the one spot. So I don't think it's a priority. I think as a player, you want to try and tick as many boxes as you can, and while prioritising your strengths, and, I mean, never forgetting that's why you might have got selected or got to this point in the first place, just ticking away on other little things. So whether it's strength and conditioning, speed, fitness, I mean, everyone has their little thing to, or multiple things to work at. So I'm aware that the type of player I am isn't a massive, big physical one. It's when you can to try and be imposing and use what you got, but then try and focus on other areas as well, around speed and agility and skill and stuff like that. So, mind you, I thought Chris and Bundy both did incredibly well, and they're two guys that can be really physical when they need to be, but then also have the skills to back it up as well. So that kind of competition for places is brilliant, because it means you can't get comfortable or let up for 1 second, and you mean it brings the best out of everyone and ultimately benefits the group. So I wouldn't say bulking up, it would be something that would be at the forefront of anyone's minds.
Last year, or we found out subsequently that the Grand Slam was targeted by Ireland. This year, the way England are going, and we saw firsthand what that is like, is it possible for the players in the squad to reset goals in the middle of a championship? I know Ireland are still in the running for this championship, but the way England are going, is it possible to reset a goal with a World Cup on the horizon?
Yeah, I think after any game, win or lose, you'd still be try and be as harsh on yourself as possible and see areas you can improve and grow in. So, I mean, that doesn't change, albeit a really disappointing loss at home, and one where you feel you might have let, you know, family, friends, supporters down, teammates down as well. You still pair back to looking at areas you can be better in and areas you can improve, like any other game. So, I think, judging on the fine margins that the games were won on last year and games were won on in November, that if you fall on the wrong side of those fine margins, then you lose a game like we did 2 weeks ago. So it's kind of just focusing on week, and obviously Italy being the next task now. England, you can't really, well, it's an uncontrollable how they go and whether they get bonus points or win games or who they're playing. So it's about focusing on the group ourselves and, yeah, and have each game at a time, and hopefully that gets us somewhere or be successful in the end.
And thanks to Gary for doing that for us with Michael. That was an event hosted by Gillette. So feeding back into the possum double bluff theory of Wes, now there's a new set of targets for the season. The championship isn't particularly target A anymore. Are we comfortable with that?
Yeah, well, I guess now this year Joe has a bit of a leeway. I thought that this would be regarded as a bit of a shot to nothing. As he says himself, he has 3 championships in 5 years. The direct quote is from Joe is, look, if we'd never won one of these before, we would be even more gutted. But we've done well in the Six Nations in the last 5 years. So if it doesn't come to pass this year, there is a big thing at the end of the year for us. That was on Saturday after the match.
I don't think you could have asked him for any more clear indication that now.
I still think, though, yeah, obviously there's a bigger picture at play, but it can go from being a ho-hum let's wait and see how it pans out in the World Cup Six Nations, to an absolute disaster with another defeat. So the idea that it's a shot to nothing and he's going to, you know, just throw out 10 new players, I think never going to happen.
Yeah, well, look, I think the Six Nations in itself, as a competition, it's been hammered this point, but it's all about momentum. And I think that the second they lost to England, as it stood, winning that competition was taken out of their hands. Okay, as long as England keep winning, it's taken out of their hands. So all they can focus on is what, and that's the sort of stuff. Joe, if nothing else, is a pragmatist from what I can see. And he'll go, right, guys, we win the next game, we win the next game, we win the next game. And then if England drop the ball somewhere, we'll be sitting in the long grass. That's all they can do as it stands now. It's not in their interest, I think, to play games.
But does it accelerate something that he wants to kind of get in, straightened out in his head? Does it bring forward some planning?
He's used 26 players in two games.
Sure, but forced to do so.
But it's the same thing, isn't it? Whether you're forced or not, you've used them.
But are you talking about developing players for a World Cup?
Well, not even players. I don't know what I'm talking about, really.
As in combinations and stuff. Look, that's not the way. It's too late for that, in my opinion. Okay. I think at this stage now, to be looking at... your team needs to be relatively settled in the year of a World Cup, in my opinion, like with the exception of one or two positions. And if he starts kind of mucking around with that, then the confidence of the team will start taking a nosedive. And remember, you've only so many games in a given year. They'll have a few warm-up matches. The summer is going to take a fair bit out of them. They'll have a conditioning period in that. A few warm-up games, World Cup. So they don't have time to be mucking around with that sort of stuff. What he needs to do now is keep the ship steady. His most important thing is confidence right now. Confidence in that team. That is it.
And the other thing worth noting is that England can afford to lose a game. If they pick up 10 points from, say, bonus point wins over Scotland and Italy, they'll get to 20, the maximum we can get to is 19. They can afford to lose to Wales, for example, and still to be out of our reach.
Yeah, I think we'll park it until the middle weekend, because the Wales-England match is going to tell us what we can expect from our own final trip to Cardiff, which could have a lot riding on it in terms of confidence, in terms of possibly championship placings, and of course in terms of momentum. But interesting how he handles April to August is the next chunk of time that has to be navigated.
And that will be determined a lot by how he finishes out this competition, remember, because your last game is what your nervous system remembers the last thing it did. Very hard. It's good that, if anything, you're going to lose a game maybe of that nature at the early stage of the competition where you can actually recover from that because you can play some games. It's harder. So, in essence... You know, in some ways, a bad thing has happened in reflection to, you know, to the confidence of the team. But at the same time, they have time to work that out and then go into that phase that you're talking about with and build.
Okay, well, England women will play the Barbarians for the first time at Twickenham this summer, and Fiona Coughlin's going to join us in just a sec. Hi, Fiona.
Hi, Dara. How's things?
Not bad. Have you a half day today?
Yeah.
Official.
Same thing. Yeah.
Nothing great. You played for the Babas, didn't you?
Yeah, back the first ever women's Babas match against Munster in Thomen Park last year. Well, 2017.
2017. Yeah, wasn't that far ago? Long ago. What's the whole culture like?
Oh, like, I suppose you played against all of these players for a number of years and probably didn't speak very fondly of them when you were planning how to get one over them, and just the minute you walk into the room after about 5 minutes, you're just getting on like a house on fire. And you know, it's just really about those friendships that you can make through rugby, and I think it transfers then onto the pitch when you go out and play together and just have fun. And we certainly did that in miserable conditions in Limerick, but scored actually the first ever try was a penalty try off a scrum. And the second try was typical Barbarians running it from our own 22 and went through a number of pair of hands and scored. But as I said, it's the friendships and the craft that we had. It was only a short time. It was only 3 days. But you travel anywhere in the world now and you'll have somewhere to stay.
Yes. Yeah, there you go. I mean, that's bringing back. What's the man who was responsible with the double barrel name? His name escapes me.
Steel Bodger.
Steely Bodger.
Mickey Steel Bodger. Yeah. Is he still kicking?
He's still there, yeah. I met him when he was over when Barbarians played against Clontarf there a couple of years ago. And he wasn't at the match down in Thomen Park now, but he's still there.
Emmett, did you ever get the nod for the Babas?
I did, yeah.
Where was your game?
We actually, there was a Barbarians versus the Combined Defence Forces, which would have been like, you know, I suppose the English guys like Tim Rodburn, these lads would have been all. So then we played them down in Portsmouth.
Naval Town? Going,
yeah, it was probably, God, the year, maybe.
Era of the 80s or something.
No, yeah, yeah. 204 maybe or something like that. Yeah, I can't remember, to be honest. But yeah, it was great. It was a brilliant experience. Like, you'd have a few pints before the game and stuff like this. It was rank amateur stuff it was a very kind of pure experience, I suppose, just saying that it was very relaxed. But when you get on the field, it was a lot of fun, yeah.
It was 93, Andrew O'Connor just told me in my ear. So yeah, it was that long ago.
Thanks, Andrew. Yeah, thanks for that.
93. Yeah, anyway, back to the Barbarians and this Twickenham match. I mean, this is shop window stuff, though, isn't it, as well? And we look at England women, who are just on fire at the moment, and the best of the rest, so it's going to be a goodie.
Oh, I think everyone's thrown their name in the hat to play that game. I was texting Fiona Stoffy, the manager, there last night. She said her phone was hopping, people looking to play, but it's invite, so I'm sure they'll sit through and see who's up for selection, and then who'd be a real Barbarian character. That's important to them as well. It's not just about how you play, it's what you bring off the pitch as well, which is important to it. I think it's going to be a really good game. You know, if you look at the current players there, a couple of English players have just retired, like Danielle Waterman and Rocky Clark. I'm sure they'll be itching to get a game for the Barbarians as well, and that'd be a nice one for them to play against England. But it'll be huge. It'll be a tough game, because England are on fire at the moment and the manner we're still playing, and they'll be a couple of months professional then at that stage, so they'll bring more to it. But yeah, I would imagine just being a double header as well, I think the atmosphere is going to be great around it.
I love the old kind of like slight secret society psychometric testing to see would you become a good Barbarian. I'd love to see the spreadsheet.
You have to be a good tourist. It's not just a physical player, you have to be a good tourist.
Fiona, Michael Glennon here.
Hi, Michael.
How are you doing? Who would you pick off the current Ireland team to play with the Babas?
Claire Malloy, just for her consistent class. You know, I think she'd walk into any team in the world, and she'd definitely add to that Barbarians team. You know, time and time again, she produces, and she's an out-and-out seven. I think it'd be phenomenal to see her in the Barbarians team. And then you've got like the Leah Lyons pushing close for somewhere in the front row spot as well.
Kira Griffin as a character, maybe.
Yeah, I just honestly think competition is going to be so...
For number eight, yeah.
For going to be so tough. I think Claire Malloy would be the type of player who'd be one of the first names that they'd be looking at, I would imagine.
Yeah. That's a good one. What's the state of play 10 days out from the middle match against Italy, which is a tough one to predict in many ways, because we saw two Italys, haven't we, in the Women's Championship so far?
Pretty much. Italy sometimes are like France, whether they decide to turn up and play or not. And they were obviously quite convincing against Scotland with a bonus point try. They didn't play a huge amount of rugby. They just kind of waited and pounced on Scotland's mistakes and scored a couple of line-out mauls. I think on their day, I think Ireland are a better team. But like Italy has some fabulous players. Franco, she got her first cap against Ireland last year, and she's just come on leaps and bounds since, and she's been one of the standout performers in the last two games. And then in the backs, they have the likes of Furlan, a fullback, and she gets any ball in open space, she's hugely exciting. She's captain as well. And Baratine at scrum half, she's a right little, I suppose, typical scrum half, a right little general. But I think across the whole balance of the team, I think Ireland are a better team. I think their set piece is far superior than Italy's is.
Good night the other night for that, yeah.
Yeah, the last two nights have been good, particularly in the scrum, and then the line-out came up trumps last week. So, I think Ireland needs to kick on now and show what we spoke about at the start, is winning those three away games, as you said, the best of the rest. And you never know then, going into the French game, what French team travels. two years ago when France came here, and against the odds, Ireland pulled up to them physically and matched them and beat them. So, I think if they get a little bit of momentum going, a bit more confidence, a bit more linking between the backs and forwards. We haven't seen a whole lot of that at the moment. It's been very much forwards do their thing, backs do their thing. So
sure.
A bit more fluidity in the squad, I think it'll be important.
It was someone who's
and
very,
also welcome back players.
Yes, I was thinking, was Bevan Parsons or Lindsay Pete going to make appearance from different ends of the spectrum, so to speak, but they'd be two wonderful additions.
Spectrum.
Yeah, but experience.
Yeah, like, obviously Lindsay would add to that pack again, even though they're motoring well. I think he would definitely add to it. Also, he's the likes of Nicole Cronin coming back from injury from half, which could be interesting as well. And then whatever number, the seventh girls, maybe add it back in if they get a good weekend under them training this weekend. Bevan Parsons, I'd love to see Eve Higgins feature at some stage.
Yes.
Although I worry, like, I've seen her play all the way up since she's under 16s, and I can see her talent. But if she was thrown in, she hasn't played a game of 15s in such a long time. And if you put her in there and she doesn't perform, I think that could be the worst thing for her. So I don't know whether...
I know, but there are so few games is the problem, isn't there, you know?
There's so few games and there's so few opportunities for the likes of her when she is. So she's one of the central seven players that to get her actually when there isn't a seventh competition on. So, but I would love to see her play at 10. You know, an area that kind of that we haven't got the complete 10 with the kick and the playmaker. We've got kind of got two separate players in that sense. So, yeah, I'd love to see her at some stage come into it.
Yeah, so would I. Okay, well, we'll see you in studio or on commentary for that in a week and a bit. Thanks for joining us, Fiona. See you soon.
See you. Thanks, Emil.
All the best. Pleasure. Yeah, somebody was saying to me what France will turn up has like just become a ridiculous thing to say now, hasn't it? Because it's the shite one. Yeah. when it's men's rugby anyway.
Look, we've said it loads of times, but I mean really the weekend had to be the all-time low thus far, didn't it? I mean, it's terrible. I mean, you think back to even just to the 90s, even a little more recently. I mean, watching France, because we didn't contest too much for championships, but as a kid, when France would pull off an upset at Twickenham, like I remember Christophe Lamizan having a great day one year, maybe around 93, 94.
Yeah, it's all
like
we
they,
got
they're almost
the
like some of the best
years.
Memories of watching rugby in
that's
my
That's the
life.
One when he was running up the wing and he put the crossfield kick in. Was
that was
it
that
Saint
was 91
Andre.
For
yeah.
Saint Andreas
yeah,
try, but sure,
try,
yeah. you could take your pick, you know.
That was from behind the goal line. It was something else. Yeah. Incredible stuff.
And yeah. they always did it from that first World Cup on in 87. Blanco touchdown after again behind their own 22.
Oh, sorry.
No, go for it. Yeah, go for it.
No, but when we talk about what France will turn up, when you say we don't know, or maybe it's the shite one, it's actually a big physical, brutish force that still turns up. Whether they're any good or not is different, but it's still, they can do a lot of damage physically on a team, even if they can be beaten.
Yeah, well, oh, fair enough. But I'm more worried about the under 20s because they have to play France, and the under 20s being a less structured type of game and an environment where physical power still has possibly more than the 20% advantage in some positions. That's where I feel our 20s could have a problem.
Yeah, I have a feeling that could be the case. And that was the case last year. They were very strong last year and just overwhelmed, I think, in a lot of cases by size.
Now they're good lads, though, our fellas.
They're brilliant. But, like, the feeder system and the underage system in Ireland is absolutely fantastic. But I just think sometimes, with you know, there's a numbers game factor with respect to, as I said, big men. And the second thing would be sometimes it just takes a year or two more for guys to mature and to get that little bit more physically competitive. That's it. They'd come through eventually, obviously. But the French team traditionally played on what was in front of them. And they were the hardest team in the world to analyse when they play their old style game. Because when you had a back three, for example, like in the early days, of Clement Poitrineau, Haymans, Cedric Haymans, and Vincent Clerc, for example, the Toulouse back row, but French back three, they just played what was in front of them and they ran lines off each other. Very hard to analyse that, very hard to kind of. But the modern game is so structured now, it's forced the French to kind of go into that kind of. It sucked them into that kind of a vortex and where they have to be structured to, and it doesn't suit their personalities. They still have very good individuals, though. But the problem is they don't respond to pressure well when it's applied to them.
It's simple, isn't it? That's the holy grail is to combine that type of intuitive rugby with a structure that can protect a lead.
Yeah, well, that's what Joe instills in the guys, because he knows that at some point, against competitive teams, I will stress this, but at some point in the game, you are going to be under pressure. And it's like the Customato saying that you always have a plan until you're punched, you know, and that's the whole, I know it's probably an overused phrase, but that's the...
It's a good one, though.
It is a good one. And the problem is, and to use another one of his, is with to coin the French, is when you're born round, you don't die square, and they are the way they are, if you know what I mean. So that's another one of his with Mike Tyson. So it's just overused as well, probably. But the thing is that they're wired a certain way and it doesn't suit them, and they lose interest quickly I suppose they're forced to go out of their comfort zone and doing things, and then as a result then when the pressure comes on they fall apart.
If you went back to 95 when the game was going pro, you think of that World Cup, Ireland steamrollered out of it Eddie Halvey, I think, got a try to get us past Wales, just about keep up our record for getting to the quarter final. Slaughtered by New Zealand in the first game. France, Abdel Benazi reached out for the try. It was an inch short of the line to beat South Africa in a semi-final in South Africa, who obviously went on to win it. Like, if you look at a country of 70 million people, an economic powerhouse versus us, and you look at the idea that they had this incredible talent and that professionalism was going to iron out the kinks of structure that saw them fall down. I mean, the idea that it would take Ireland on the road to where we are and them on the road to where they are, especially considering their domestic league is still the most lucrative in the world. Now, I know that's part of the problem and all the rest of it, but it really is incredible the turnaround in fortunes that that has prompted, you know.
They haven't been able to anticipate the hard parts of rugby. They're able to work themselves up into a frenzy. They're very quite, you know, in a very temperamental sense. And in any one game, given game, they can go to hell and come back, if you know what I mean. But in terms of being able to bottle the anticipation of what the difficult components of rugby are, like, that's the bits where they're not running and, you know, an attack and having space. It's where you're grinding out a win or where they're under pressure for certain areas of the game. They can't seem to kind of come up with a solution to kind of get their minds to compete in those areas.
They're not interested in such petty matters.
Well, that's it would appear that way. But that's one of the strengths of the Joe Schmidt era, is that he's taught the
players. He's Germanized Ireland, if we're going to have national stereotypes made as well.
Okay. Forget the name. Yeah, so I mean, that's it really. Yeah, I mean, it's when you're under pressure, how you react under that pressure, and he gives the players the ability to anticipate that so they can actually deal with those problems.
Great, lads, I really enjoyed that. Thanks for all of your contributions, Michael, Wes, Fiona, and Emmett Byrne. Thank you for listening to the RTE Rugby podcast, and we'll be back to you next week.